There's nothing better than telling somebody, so see you later. You know, it's like, no, I'm not going to do that. Let's cut ties here. I really appreciate, that you came to me, and I'm sorry that we can't work to work together, and I wish you the best of luck.
Hey everybody, welcome to The Creative Rising, a series of conversations on career, courage, and creative leadership. I'm your host, Blake Howard, and we are recording live at Constellation Studio in historic Sweet Auburn in Atlanta, Georgia. And today we're talking about style, swagger, sizzle, and how some people just seem to have it. You look at them and you think, man, that person is so cool. How did they do that? Maybe it's a famous graphic designer like Michael Beirut, maybe an architect like Bjark Ingels, or maybe an industrial designer like Dieter Rams. The one thing they all have in common is an ability to form a very distinct point of view. They're known for a belief or a style or an approach or an idea, and they've all been on some sort of an adventure to find their own voice. It didn't just happen overnight. It took time to have power in their perspective. And that's what we're going to talk about today. What does it look like to discover not just who you are, but what you can do really well and what you believe should happen in your profession? What does it look like to find your own unique style? And our guest today is Brian Steely, who has done just that. He's a graphic designer with a big following because of his unique monoline style. So for those non-designers out there, that's just a single line weight to do lots of different illustrations with. For more than 20 years, he's been perfecting that style and his overall design abilities, and he's got a bit of a rock star reputation. He's designed things for Nike, Element, Mumford & Sons, Fish, pro football teams, the national parks, and tons and tons and tons of killer beer and beverage packaging. I'm excited to learn from Brian today and to get his perspective on finding and sustaining your style. So Brian, thanks for being here. Glad to have you with us. First, why don't you give us a little bit of your backstory and maybe all the way up to what you felt like was your first big break?
Thanks for having me, Blake. I would say my backstory, I grew up in Atlanta, so I was always drawing and always playing outside and doing all the things that kids did back then without the cell phones and the computer screens and all that. And went off to school to be an English major. So I kind of got away from where I was headed as an artist. I got into school and I realized that even though my dad had worked at the paper for 36 years at the AJC and my mom was an English major and an English teacher, I realized that that might not be what I wanted it to be. So I started taking art classes again and got really submersed in art and less in English. And it just kind of led, it just kept on leading me back. Everything that happened in college kept on leading me back to art. And that's pretty much the backstory right there.
Yeah. And so what did you do right when you got out of school?
So before I got out of school, I had the opportunity. One of the bands I liked a lot was Widespread Panic. And I found out they were going to play a show at the Fox Theater, or run at the Fox Theater. And it's like my favorite venue, my favorite band at the time. I used it as an opportunity. Their posters weren't very good at the time. So I used it as an opportunity to like create this poster and did a little sketch, mailed it to them. They actually got back in touch with me, and I ended up creating the poster for them. And that was like a pivotal moment in my career that I didn't realize at the time was anything more than creating a poster.
So you just sketched an idea and sent it to them. Was it just like a pencil sketch?
A pencil sketch. I was, this is what I think Widespread Panic is. It's a dragon standing on top of the world, breathing fire.
Naturally, of course.
Yeah, of course, right? And just pencil sketched it out and literally put it in the mail and mailed it to them. And because we had no internet.
And they actually got back to you.
They called me at my parents' house in the summertime.
Did your mom answer the phone?
On the landline. Yeah, mom answered the phone. Had a big smile on her face, handed me the phone.
Was she like, Brian, it's Widespread Panic calling?
Something very similar to that, actually.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so you had a little taste for art and even getting this poster gig out of your favorite band. And so you did the poster, they liked it, and then did you just keep going from there?
No, I kind of tucked that poster away and went on. I graduated from school and came out an English major looking for a job. And I got an internship at a local PR firm of 9 people. And still, you know, this was pre – well, internet was around, but it wasn't like the robust interweb that it is now.
Yeah, it was like chat rooms.
Yeah, it was like making all those noises, yeah. You know. And you go in the production room to use it, and it was not anywhere near what it is now.
I've always thought about those noises. Like, why did they make those noises?
They were horrible.
Like, did you have to make – the noise? Like, I get that technically it was doing things, but there was no one to think, hey, let's just silence that, or like, let's make it sound really pleasant. It just did
nothing cool.
Whatever technical was happening, you just got to hear that.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I spent a lot of my time in that production room, like organizing it and reorganizing people's Rolodexes and doing just menial stuff that I was just happy to have a job at this point. And still, I had not touched a computer. I had no idea what Adobe was. I had not touched a computer to do any form of design. And so about 6 months into my internship, they came to me and said, our graphic designer is leaving. Why don't you be our graphic designer? And I said, I don't think it works quite that way. I think I need to go back to school. So off I went to the Portfolio Center to try to get enrolled in the Portfolio Center.
Wow. I love that. That's cool.
Yeah.
And so once you got out of Portfolio Center, were you full-fledged graphic design at that point?
So I never really got out of the Portfolio Center. I spent 3 quarters there. And since I was paying for it myself, I was really putting everything I had into it, and they said, you know, don't have a job while you're at the Portfolio Center. Mm. You don't have a job. Take that, you know. So I spent many nights sleeping on the office floor between, like, working my 30 hours a week at the job, which they cut it back a little bit for me because I was going to school, and then doing my other job, which was school again. And since I was paying for it myself at this point, I realized that, you know, I was getting a lot of value out of it, but I was also getting a lot of value by teaching myself. So I just said, I'm going to take a break and see how I go just teaching myself from this point. And it was slow going.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's hard to balance both of those at once. You eventually got to a place where you're doing snowboards for Burton. What happened in between that? Because that seems like you sketch a poster, you mail it, and it just lands. It's like a huge big break. But then you get to a place where you're designing decks and you're working with Burton. What happened in between that?
A lot of years. I had, you know, I went through a dark period where I was not sure that I wanted to be a designer. I had kids that slowed me down a little bit.
I think kids and dark years overlap sometimes.
Yeah, they overlap for sure. And I don't regret it at all. But it's like, yeah, I've been through some hard, like really hard times with design where I'm like, like I said earlier, I'm not a perfectionist. So I make a ton of small typos and stuff like that. And once I got away from that and started getting back to like my roots of creating, sketching and drawing and creating logos that were, you know, didn't have a lot of types, so I couldn't mess a lot of stuff up. Like I couldn't misspell the name of the company because they would send that to me in an email.
Yeah.
Cut and paste.
Yeah.
It took I was designing brochures, billboards, I did websites. It was a long, hard road, and it was a lot of there was a lot of peaks in it, and there was a lot of valleys. I saw my logo on a water tower. That was huge for me when I was 4 years into designing. And then I saw my billboard up, and that was neat too. And little things happened along the way that made me keep on going.
Yeah. Wow. So when did you first start exploring that monoline that's become so synonymous with your work?
That didn't happen until about 5 years ago. I was doing a lot of work at the agency. Our PR firm became an agency, and I've been there the whole time. So it's been
– That's a whole nother interview.
Yeah, that's a whole nother interview, so I'll stay away from that. But I was doing a lot of work that was not super fulfilling to me. It was a lot of production work, a lot of like photo shoots, a lot of press checks. And I really wanted something that was more simple and direct way of reaching people. I thought that some of the ways that we were going about doing things were not wrong, but I wanted to go approach it a different way.
Yeah.
So I started doing this monoline thing in my free time. I was doing hand lettering. That I was extremely decent at that, but not great. So I moved on to this sketching, and I was sketching at night and coming up. And my sketches weren't even that great, but they used to be. And now that I had the computer that I knew how to use, I started scanning them and tracing them on the computer and refining. And I was like, wow, this is really working out. I'm sketching and doing this refining process, and it's starting to gel into something that I was really enjoying doing. And I was doing it just for the love of doing it, nothing more.
Wow. So do you think it's good for designers to be known for something like that? Like your visual aesthetic has been very attractive to people like Nike and Burton or Mumford & Sons or Widespread Panic. Like, people want your aesthetic and your style. So it's clearly been beneficial for you, and you've kind of, you know, even grown a little bit of a following around that style. But in general, do you think that's something that's good for designers to have?
I once had a mentor that told me, keep yourself invisible while keeping your client visible. And I honestly think that's the worst possible advice you give to a graphic designer. I think it's very important that you get yourself out there and you make a name for yourself, because then people start coming to you for your specific style.
Yeah.
If you hide behind, you know, your agency or whatever, people are never going to know who you are. So yeah. I found this out the hard way. But I think it's really important to get yourself out there. Don't be scared of putting your work out there and letting people find out who you are.
Yeah. You mentioned this a little bit, that you liked the monoline style. It was something you felt like you could just do. Did you feel like it was really unique at the time also? Like, was that part of it?
It was not a lot of people were doing it. And I wanted to kind of own it and make it my – do things a little differently within it to really make it my own and make it more unique than just straight out monoline.
Yeah.
And the problem with this too, there's a flip side, is you can get pigeonholed into just doing this one style.
Yeah.
Which isn't always good.
Yeah. Do most of your clients now come asking for that style?
They all do. And if I try to do something different, they don't like it.
They're like, no, I saw this one thing you did
on
the
can you do something with wings?
There's a lot of animals in your stuff too. Is there something behind that? Like, you're like, I just love wolves and elk.
I'm trying to fill Noah's Ark up. I have always had a love for nature. And no one's going to tell you when they look at a wolf that it doesn't look like a wolf. I'm not a great at drawing people. So, like, if I drew you, Blake, it might not look like you. But, you know, I draw a wolf, they're like, that looks like a wolf.
Yeah.
That doesn't look like Blake, though.
Oh, yeah.
So I kind of stick to animals when I can.
I'm almost in that exact same boat. I try to avoid drawing female characters almost always, but like of a realistic version of someone I know. Because I'll always get something wrong, and I can never make them like quite look the way that they actually do.
And that'll get you in so much trouble.
One time, actually, my wife was like, hey, my mom's graduating. What if you drew a really big caricature portrait of her? So I'm like, so let me get this right. You want me to draw a realistic cartoon version of my mother-in-law and then give it to her as a gift? She's like, yeah. And I ended up doing it. But I was sweating. Like, I worked multiple nights on that thing, and it ended up turning out like not offensive, like okay, you know. But I was so nervous
that she was going to
see it, and the nose is going to be way too big, or like one eye is going to be higher than the other, or whatever. And it just made me sweat. So wolves are the way to dodge that.
Wolves, eagles.
I could have in that moment said, "Hey, what about if we
turn her into
a wolf? What if we? Yeah, maybe it's a wolf picture instead. Happy retirement. Here's a giant snarling wolf."
You would have saved yourself some time.
Yeah, I like that. That's good. So most creatives will be hired either by clients or by an employer, kind of a full-time gig, because they bring a distinct expertise to the table. Like this idea that voice leads to value. Like if you have a unique perspective, that's really valuable and people want to hire that. What does it take, do you think, to be known for something unique, whether it's a style or a perspective or an approach?
Well, I'll tell you what it took for me. It took a lot of work, a lot of hours away from the office, and a lot of just like thinking about it, you know, ways to make it different, ways to evolve it. When this all was happening, I had two young children and a wife, and I was wondering how much I could get away with before my wife told me no more. So you really have to work at developing it. And like anything else, if you're going to be great at it, you have to really work hard and you have to put in the effort and the time.
Yeah. It takes a lot of time to perfect, especially to perfect a craft.
Like the hand
lettering you mentioned, like so many people love to just draw a quick little word and take a picture and post it. But the craft and the detail that's required to make it actually sound and look good is a whole nother level.
And I think that the thing that drove me away from hand lettering is I didn't have the patience for that. And I think the thing that really drove me to this style that I have is it's relatively simple. This can also be very complex, but I can finish the piece fairly quickly and move on to the next thing. So it's for my ADD brain, it's like, well, you know, I've completed something, put it out to the world, move on to the next thing. It flows a lot smoother than some of the stuff I was doing in the office.
Yeah. Was there a piece that you created that you thought, wow, this is awesome? Like do you remember the first piece, maybe beyond the Widespread Panic poster, that you created something you're like, this is really cool, I'm really proud of this?
I mean, everything I've created so far, Blake.
Everything, no, always. It must meet my 10-point requirement standard before I ever hit send.
That's a really good question. There's several things that made me proud, and not because they're my best work, just because where they hit, when they hit. Like I did a metal bike badge, and I'm really proud of that because I've always wanted it. Was on my bucket list, so that happened. And it wasn't because I got paid a lot or, you know, I got a lot of notoriety from it. It was just because that's something that I loved and wanted, and it was on my bucket list to do, and I accomplished it. So, you know, some things are worth more than just the paycheck.
Yeah. How do you think about taking on new projects? Do you think about that when you take something on? Like, are you thinking, hey, this is on my bucket list, so regardless of their budget, I'm going to try to figure it out? Or how do you think about even just taking work on?
I don't really have the luxury where I can pick and choose yet. So I pretty much take on everything that's like within my moral compass and can move forward with. But I do everything from, you know, like a doctor's logo to a brewery logo. You know, it just doesn't matter. As long as if the client comes to me for my style and they really want to work with me, then I'm really want to work with them because it means we've got something in common and can collaborate on something. And that's important to me, is just to make that bond with the client. And it's huge because before I developed this style, it wasn't the client coming specifically to me for my style. It was the client coming to me because kind of they had to almost. You're going to work with this guy and he's going to do a brochure for you. But they're coming to me. I'm not going looking for it yet. So they're coming to me and looking for my style. So we've kind of crossed a barrier already.
Yeah.
And it makes it fun.
Yeah.
It's exciting. Well,
that's one advantage for anyone listening that's thinking, should I have a style or should I not? Then when you have a distinct style, it will attract people, and you already have that box checked. You don't have to go through a few rounds of just understanding, you know, hey, which visual direction should we explore? Like you kind of already have the building blocks there.
Exactly. It really makes things a lot easier. And that was one of the things that was the hardest part for me was, and any young designer probably, is getting started.
This idea of imposter syndrome is real, especially in the graphic design world. And it's easy to mimic whatever's trendy or in vogue right now, or something that's popular on Dribbble or Instagram. I love Dribbble. I think it's a great way for design community to be built. But it's real easy to just see something that looks good and slick and stylish, and you just kind of regurgitate it over and over and over. So What advice would you give to people listening to not clone stamp or visually regurgitate what's already out there, but to actually do something a little bit different?
You know, I think that I get on Dribbble, not as much as I used to, but it's a great source of inspiration, obviously, as well as Instagram. And there's distinct styles out there. I think it's important that if you're inspired by something, that you point to that inspiration when you do a piece and give them credit. Mm. But, you know, it's nothing wrong with taking a piece of somebody, something, and making it your own, or you know, coming up with a different way to solve the puzzle. I mean, most of this stuff's been done before, so we're not like – it's not like we're breaking new ground, really. But the only time I get really frustrated is when people, like, just flat-out trace something I've done and, like, we'll change, like, a couple things, and that's just flat-out stealing. You know?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's a whole different ball game.
There's a guy named Todd Henry that I like, and he has a podcast called Accidental Creative, and he has a quote that says – cover bands don't change the world. And I love that idea, because when you're just mimicking whatever you see out there, how would you ever move the macro world of graphic design or any profession forward? You know, you're just stuck in this repeat sort of cycle, and it takes someone to kind of push the envelope to shift trends, or to mm-hmm. shift the way that that people start to think or approach the work in general.
For sure.
Yeah. What's the role of confidence in someone's ability to establish that distinct voice? Because it feels like, for you even, to say, you know what, I'm going to really continue to do this style that I love, that I think is really effective and cool, and I'm just going to keep doing it. Like, that takes a little bit of confidence from your own perspective. How does that play into others trying to find their voice as well?
I think that plays into it a lot. And as I mentioned before, too, is like putting yourself out there, putting your work out there, and letting it be critiqued. A lot of people are scared to just take that first step and, you know, open yourself up to criticism and put that work out there and just continue to put it out there. And you'll see yourself grow. I mean, it's such an important thing with confidence, is just to be putting yourself out there.
Yeah, you just kind of have to go for it.
You have to go for it.
Yeah.
And if you're reserved and just sitting back, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. It is interesting in graphic design, and I'm sure other professions, but your imprint of yourself is in your work. And so when someone doesn't like it, what you hear is like, they don't like me.
Yeah, for sure.
Versus someone who puts together a budget and a spreadsheet, and they're like, hey, those numbers are off. You're like, cool, I'll fix them. But in our world, it's like, they don't like me as a person. They think I'm
soul's
terrible.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I'm the worst. All these voices crop up.
Oh, yeah, that definitely still affects me. I mean, I'm not going to lie and say that I'm impervious to that kind of, you know, feedback. It's just out there, and you hope for the best. You hope that more people like you than more people don't.
Yeah. Do you ever get negative feedback on any of your posts?
Occasionally. Occasionally I'll get, you know, you didn't kern that letter right. And true enough, I didn't kern that letter right.
And, like, hey, thanks for the tip.
I know how to kern, so that's, you know, that's on me. I'm not perfect. And, you know, I think that's one thing that's cool when I started doing this is I set out to create this style that wasn't perfect and had more of an art sense to it than a design sense. I mean, art and designer, it's kind of the same, but a traditional art molded with the design. So I would complete a piece, and then I'd add texture or something and mess it up a little bit and roughen it up, because I think that imperfection, humans are drawn to that to a degree because it's very human.
Yeah. 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 I think the whole world of feedback and commentary is really interesting also. Of unlike any other design professionals before, there's this internet out there that people can comment one way on. So I think about like some really like Saul Bass walking down the street and someone coming up and be like, hey, you didn't kern that letter right. You know, like no one would have said that to Saul Bass.
He never would have not kerned his letter.
That's
right.
True. He would have not had any weakness. He didn't have weakness. But what if they were like, hey, I don't like that color you chose? He'd be like, get out of my face.
Yeah, you know?
It just wouldn't have happened. It's a different It's a different world nowadays. Everyone has an opinion. Everyone has the voice or the ability to comment. So it's just a little bit of a different world.
It's a totally different monster for sure.
Yeah. So I've been defining courage as the ability to reject indifference, really in our work. So pushing ourselves and our abilities, but then also in those that we work with. So having the courage to push through an argument with a coworker or fight for work that you believe in or build a relationship with a boss. What about for you? What does rejecting indifference look like?
With a client, I feel like indifference usually comes from just from the people I deal with because they're already coming to me for my style. I think it's they're not as involved as I thought they would be, and that they're not they want the piece and they want it now and they're done. They don't have anything to do with me. They don't get my best work really. And I don't do that intentionally. It's just, it's harder for me to put myself into it when they're not giving me their all back. I think that a lot of things come into play for that. Like, in this day and age, everything has to be done so fast that people don't take the time to like give you the time to do it right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's my biggest problem with it.
It's very rare to have a client that's like, hey, just take your time.
Yeah, never.
Just make it as good as you can.
And if they tell you, just take your time, they always come back like 3 days later and are like, where is it?
Where are we? Yeah.
And I'm like, you told me to take my time.
Yeah. And that also seems like an increase in the overall climate, that people want things faster and faster and faster.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, yeah.
It's got to be a macro trend around people's expectations when listening to any song in the whole world on Spotify or watching any Netflix show on their phone. We're just so spoiled now with speed and access.
Yeah, it's the age of instant gratification, and it's just it's not going to go anywhere. I mean, it's sad, but and I don't think that a lot of people give designers the respect that they need to do their job properly. You know, doctors and lawyers don't get second guessed very often, but you know, designers get second guessed all the time.
Yeah, like you would never say to a doctor like, hey, I appreciate that perspective. If you could just like maybe the incision that you're going to do for the surgery, if you could just move it a little bit, maybe like instead of right over my heart, could you just go in my ribs?
And make it bigger.
Make it a little bit. Yeah, actually make my incision a little bigger. Perfect. Yeah, that doesn't really happen.
No, never.
Yeah. What are some tips when you get the speed pressure or when you get the timeline pressure? How do you typically handle that? What are some tips that you could give to others that are under that same pressure?
When I get pressure for speed, I typically move fast already. So my whole thought process when I start a project is I'll think about whatever I'm designing in my head for maybe a day or 2 days, and I'll have a clear vision of what it's going to look like, and that's doing research and everything else. But before I even put my pencil to a piece of paper, I know what I'm going to be drawing because it's in my head. And I think that's really speeds things along.
Yeah. What about, like, do you ever have a way to diffuse the speed question? Like when a client's like, all right, Brian, I know you said you can give me that on Friday, but I really need it tomorrow.
I'm in the fortunate place where it's just me running my business. So I'll tell them, no, I can't do that. I've got, you know, my calendar's full. And I will also build out, like account teams do, they always give you fake deadlines. I'm not scared to give fake deadlines too, and build myself an extra week, and just tell them that's the way it's going to be. And then if I finish it faster, hey, they're happy.
Yeah. And so you're in a unique position where if they're like, well, if you can't get it to me by tomorrow, then this is not going to happen. And what would you say in that situation?
Say, see you later. I mean, like, cool. we're not working together.
Yeah.
And I've gotten to do that a few times, and there's nothing better than telling somebody, so see you later. You know, it's like, no, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
Let's cut ties here. I really appreciate, you know, that you came to me, and I'm sorry that we can't work together, and I wish you the best of luck.
Yeah. I wish that more people felt empowered to make a decision like that, because I think most graphic designers or copywriters or art directors or maybe people in an agency or even in an in-house, they get a command from a client or a boss and it's like, I have to fulfill that. And I wish people better understood boundaries or knew how to push back, you know, in the right way, or were empowered to say, sorry, that really doesn't work. We already have other obligations or we already have other commitments.
For sure. And the first time I did it, I was so frustrated and I went to one of my bosses because I am inside of an agency running my one-man show. And I said, hey, this is not working out with this client. They said, you know, tell them to get lost. And I was like, I can do that. And they're like, yeah.
You're like, wow.
And I was like, wow, the power I have.
Didn't even know.
And it felt so good. I have this big flaw that I always want to please everybody. But it felt really, really good to say no and to kind of tell them to get lost. You know, I felt very empowered moving forward.
Did you send them like an email with giant Comic Sans that said get lost in like purple and red?
No, I'm going to do that next time though. Fuchsia.
All right. So when you think about the creative community in general, the large creative community, what would be your like motivational football coach halftime speech for that group? What do you feel like they need to hear right now?
I mean, looking at the folks I work with and just the folks in general, I think that we can all work harder and push ourselves a little bit more and push ourselves out there a little bit more. Let yourself be open for criticism and ask for criticism, ask for critiques. We're all scared of that to a degree. I think when we're younger and as we get older, we realize how helpful that is. That's about it.
Hmm. You mentioned before to find your voice and to establish your style, it just requires effort. It's just a journey. It's hard work. And I feel like that idea is lost sometimes. Like there is a rise, and I don't want to sound old, at the risk of sounding old, there is a rise in younger creative professionals, maybe right out of school, maybe 2 to 3 years out of school, and they feel like, I need to be a senior designer already, or I need to be a senior writer. I've really put in my hard work. I know how to run every project. And it seems like this idea that seniority is based on tenure and experience, and you're just not quite there yet, but they have this expectation that they're not successful unless they've been deemed senior or something akin to that within a few years of their career.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the millennial generation, and I admire the confidence. I mean, it's awesome to see. I definitely didn't have it when I was starting out in my first couple of years. But it's also, you know, you do need to go, you need to put in your time and figure out how everything works before you just jump up the ladder. It shouldn't just be handed to you. And I think we have a tendency in this day and age to hand people things, and parents do, and it just gets ingrained in them, and it's a problem.
Yeah. It almost seems like the character that they need to develop is built out of some resiliency and some bumps and some bruises and some hard work. And it's just really difficult to microwave that or to do some sort of shortcut around it. And I do think that there's a lot of talented people that could be elevated to a higher place of authority in an agency or in-house somewhere. And they could do a really fantastic job. I'm not saying that all young people mm-hmm. shouldn't be promoted, but it seems like more and more the expectation is within a few years, I'll be an owner. I'll be a partner. I'll be senior, you know?
And maybe. I mean, maybe you will, maybe you will be, but chances are, I mean, I've been through so many hard knocks and made so many mistakes. And, you know, I think it's so important that you make those mistakes and you get those hard knocks and you learn from them. And you're not going to get all those hard knocks just like right out of the gates. You know, it's going to take time and you're going to learn from them and you're going to keep on moving forward. But yeah, I think it's a problem, and maybe that's part of the instant gratification thing that we were talking about earlier. It's just the generation we're in now where everything is available instantly and you just think that you've earned it. I don't know.
Yeah. It is interesting too how the average tenure for creative agencies is 2 years. That's a new thing, and you're coming from a place of 20 plus.
Right. I think honestly, I think that and I you could probably correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's having to work on the same account for 2 years. Maybe you get burnt out and tired of it. I was fortunate enough to where I was touching anywhere in the neighborhood of like 80 to 100 clients in a year, like just doing different things for them when I was starting out. And so I never really got tired of it because I was every day was like a new day. But I can totally see how you get burned out after working with the same client for, you know, 2 years.
Yeah.
I did it with a couple clients for longer and I made it work. So.
Yeah. And there's so many agencies, especially that are out there that are out of balance, that just work people to death. Or they have really boring work, or it's just not a very fulfilling, encouraging place. So it's almost unfair to blame younger people for the two years.
Yeah,
a lot of times it's the context that they're in.
I don't blame younger people at all for that. And I also realize that, you know, if you stay at a place for 2 years and you switch, you're going to get more money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's people – I personally – I'm not in it for the money. I'm in it because I love it. I love what I do. And it's so important to love what you do because it makes it – it really makes it not a job anymore. They say that, but it's totally true. If you love what you do, it's not a job. But, yeah, if you're not loving what you're doing, you can hop a job and maybe you'll love it at the next job. But I feel like you need to stay at a place for long enough to prove yourself. And that takes more than 2 years to really dig in and to do some great work.
Yeah. A friend of mine, Chris Coleman, who was on the first season, she says that if you're ever thinking about making a jump, maybe you're right at that 2 year itch point, ask yourself, is there anyone here that'll tell me the truth? Like, is anyone willing to give me feedback to help me in my career? And if the answer is no, then you should definitely leave.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't already have relationships where you feel like they're valuable and people are helping you get better, that's the first question to ask. And I've always loved that.
That's great.
Yeah. All right. So as a creative professional, what are you afraid of and how do you try to overcome that?
There's this movie, you might've heard of it, called Maximum Overdrive.
Oh yeah.
I'm terrified that the machines are going to take over.
Man, that movie was so scary.
So scary.
But pretty dumb if you think about it.
Yeah, I'm totally kidding. I think the thing that I'm most afraid of for me is that my style is going to disappear and go away, and like I won't have the work at the end of, you know, at the end of the year.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the same. I worry about the same stuff everybody else worries about. That's a designer. I worry about going over budget, and I do that quite a bit because the speed thing that we talked about, you know, it's so hard to get the work done in the amount of time at the rate you're billing out at, and I don't know, it's just one of those things.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the downside maybe to the perspective of you really should have a distinct style is if you can't evolve that style,
yeah,
you could be a one-trick pony.
Yep.
And styles come and go.
They do.
That's why they're called trends.
And, you know, it made me feel better because Logo Lounge releases their trends report every year. And, you know, I was in the first year, like 5 years ago. And I was like, oh, shit. This is going to be like, this is dead now. And then the next year I was in the trends report. And the next year I was in the trends report. And the next year I was in the trends report. I'm like, so when does this not... When is this not a trend anymore and it becomes a thing?
Yeah.
I think what's nice about my style is that it has a foot in the past and it's got a foot in the future. It looks like it could be 40 years old or it looks like it could be 40 years in the future.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I feel pretty good about that. But, you know, I still fear the Reaper.
Yeah. Well, there's probably some wisdom in trying to think about your own style if you're trying to figure that out or carve it out. And to think, is this capitalizing off of some sort of trend that might be gone
mm-hmm.
in a little while? Where with the monoline style, it really has been around as an illustration form forever, ever since there was just probably one sort of sized spike that you're chiseling into the side of stone.
Cave, yeah,
because it was the same width. So it was just always going to kind of generally look like the same stroke width.
And my, that's so true. It has been around forever. My biggest problem with that, too, is that I have tried to evolve it, and I've done things to evolve it that are small, and people notice it, and people comment on it. But the clients are coming to me for this style, and I try to do something a little different or try to change it up, and they don't like it. You know, it's like not what they want. So I've kind of, I don't want to say I pigeonholed myself, but because I still do other kind of logos too. People just don't see them.
Yeah. You just don't post them.
I do post them, and they, you know, they don't get the likes that the other stuff does.
Classic. So this is totally a design nerd joke. On a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being like the worst, how much do you hate the preloaded brushes in Adobe Illustrator?
Haven't touched them.
They're the worst.
They're so bad.
Anytime I see them out, like on some logo or whatever, you're like, oh, come on, man.
It's bad.
You just clicked a button and made that look like a brush.
Yeah, I've honestly got three tools I think I use in Illustrator. The pen tool, the scissor tool. That's pretty much it.
No, you don't use the knife tool?
I've tried the knife. I don't.
I don't understand.
I can cut things, and then I don't know what happens. You know.
It's yeah.
I love the scissors though.
Yeah. The knife tool is always, it would like slice up your artboard. So you're like, oh, now I can just save out chunks of the work. But I never really understood the utility of it.
No. I've if you get me an Illustrator, I know what I need to know about it, and that's it. And I work on it all day long, but I haven't. I needed some of the stuff, you know. It's just like the brushes. Don't even look at this, thanks.
Yeah. Well, it dawns on me, I was kind of being silly, but it dawns on me that when you do have a distinct style, you become really good at that style and super efficient. So you don't need all of the bells and whistles and software or different tools or programs or whatever. You just have a couple things that you know how to do that, and that's super streamlined.
Yeah, it is, and I'm laughing at myself, but I do like every time a new feature comes out, I learn how to use it and make sure I know what's going on. But I open Photoshop to add texture to my logos, and that's pretty much the only reason I open Photoshop these days. I open InDesign because I sometimes have to like write a little paper or something, but I don't use. It's just become. I've become so narrow in my focus that it's and I love it because it's all about where I wanted to be in the branding side of things to creating logos. Is I don't need to open the other programs.
Mm, yeah, that's good. Well, Brian, thanks for your time today. Thanks for doing what you've done over the years and to have such a beautiful style that so many people are inspired by, and for just being a great designer and a great guy and for being willing to be here today. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Blake. Appreciate it.
Okay, that's a wrap for today's episode. Be sure to check out more from Brian Steely at steelyworks.com. Also, if you have an idea for a show or a topic that you're wrestling with, please let me know. I'd love to do a show about it. You can go to thecreativerising.com and just drop me a quick note. Next time on The Creative Rising, we're going to talk to designer and writer Armin Witt of Under Consideration about his well-known blog, Brand New, where he shares his strong opinions on the most recent and notable rebrands of the world. We're going to discuss the courage to critique and what does it look like to give your opinion even when it's unsolicited. It's going to be a good one. You are not going to want to miss out. And as always, help us spread the word. Tell a friend or leave us a review. It really does help more people find the show. And a big shout out to Matchstick, the brand identity house of the South. Visit matchstick.com, that's M-A-T-C-H-S-T-I-C, to see how this creative agency leads brands to their best. And also thank you to Constellations Studio in historic Sweet Auburn. Be sure to visit them at constellations.community.